In this episode of the Bear Performance Podcast.
So you got to be out there. You know, I mean, just like in hunting, you're never going to kill anything from your couch wondering, you know, I wonder if the hunting good. I wonder if the weather's good. I wonder what the animals are doing. Get out there and anything can happen. But you have to be out there, take that first step and just be in the woods or, and even with running, and I know you get this a lot too, but people don't know where to start. Start by getting out that freaking of that house, closing that door and just getting outside and just starting, just do something. And then you build on that. But it doesn't have to be anything crazy. It doesn't have to be, you know, a marathon or it doesn't have to be an ultra marathon. It has to be walking around the block. That's where it starts. That's where everybody starts. You walk around the block, or maybe you run a mile, or maybe you walk a mile. And just that consistent effort will lead you to go one more. And then who knows where you end up.
Welcome back to another powerful episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Nick Bear, founder and CEO of Bear Performance Nutrition. Every week, we bring you insightful stories, knowledge, and inspiration to help you reach your full potential in life, fitness, and business. If you enjoy the message we're promoting in this podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you would leave a rating and review on the platform you are listening to. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes that embody the Go One More mindset. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Bear Performance Podcast. Today we have Cameron Haynes. What's going on, brother?
Not much. Ready to have a nice discussion and learn more about Nick Bear.
No, it's all about you.
I'm impressed. I'm walking to this facility. I'm impressed, dude.
I appreciate that.
What you've built is incredible. I've seen it online and I've seen you share some behind the scenes stuff, but being here firsthand and then looking across the way and seeing the other building you had to obtain to put more storage for more product, and the guy, everybody was smiling. Everybody's in a good mood. All your employees, it's just, I can't say how happy I am to see this. Your success is hard earned and I love seeing people like you win.
I appreciate that. It's, we did Leadville 100, this past summer,
right?
Our whole team really. And, during the documentary, one of the things my wife said as I was watching the doc back,
yeah,
I got choked up, and I don't get choked up much, but I got choked up during, you know, watching this doc back. And one of the things Steph said in her interview was, you know, seeing all these people bought into this mission.
Right.
And when you think about that, like the reason I got so emotional during this part of it is when people believe in when you believe in so much,
right,
you're so bought into something. And when other people believe that much into it too, it's,
yeah,
you don't take that for granted.
No, because so many times we go through life and we feel like we're misunderstood, or they just don't see the same picture you see or the same vision. And it's like they can't understand. And so you're doing all this. And many people say you're wasting your time or it's not a good idea, or it's, you know, they'll give all these reasons to quit. But when you have a team that says you can do it, we believe in you, after your whole life of hearing the exact opposite, I understand it's emotional. You know, it's, this journey is so crazy, so filled of ups and downs, and you meet new people and you come across new challenges. And just when it's a success, like your, you know, Leadville, I watched that film and I know I can see what you're talking about exactly, because your team was there for you. You were the one achieving the goal, but everybody was just as dedicated as you were. It's awesome.
No, it's crazy with a journey. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a journey.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to compare our journey to someone else's journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the struggle is we sometimes compare our first step to someone else's 20,000.
Exactly, you know, yeah.
First step or step. So I love the quote, like, comparison is the thief of joy.
Exactly.
And one question I'd love to kick off, you know, this conversation with is, because I get this response from people too sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, the it must be fucking nice.
Yeah.
It must be nice to be able to train and hunt all day. When did you start getting those responses?
Man, I think probably for the most part, I started to get to go on great hunts. You know, I mean, as hunters, and I fell in this trap too. When I was a young hunter, I would look at the most famous hunters out there, bow hunters, that, and that's all I ever really cared about was the bow hunting gurus, essentially. And that was Chuck Adams. Fred Bear was older, you know, so he's a little generation before me. But Dwight Shue is a guy I look towards, Randy Ulmer. And I would see Chuck Adams and he'd say, well, he went and killed 10 great animals on 10 great bow hunts, and some were world records. And to me, as this kid, I was, as you mentioned, comparing my first steps, I was just starting to bow hunting, to his, you know, 20 years down the road. And I had convinced myself that I could do what he was doing. I just didn't have the opportunity. And he got to go on better hunts. He didn't have a job. I don't know if he had a job or not, but in my head, I was like, he doesn't have a job. This is all he does. And so I was like, the must be nice guy, right? Because I was the kid who was jealous of this pioneer in archery. And I didn't see the big picture. I was focused on not his journey, but just where he was at compared to where I was at. So I know exactly all this comparisons, thief of joy, all this must be nice. I know all of it because I was that guy also. Then when it really turned up is when I started, when Joe Rogan came in the picture, we became friends. And, you know, that's just a guy everybody wants to be friends with. He's just a man's man, just a cool guy, smart. Everybody sees him doing, you know, cage side at UFC, it's comedian. His podcast people, you know, are just, they gear their life around almost listening to it. So then that really took it up another notch, but it's almost, you can take it. So these people are letting somebody else's success impact them, which is a negative for them. I see it as it's, you know, it's just part of the deal. It's just what comes with success. And if I'd rather deal with a little bit of that and have success than be the guy saying must be nice and looking at people achieving more than me. So
you think that's why you've kept a full-time job? Because I mean, up until this point, obviously, a lot of things you're doing outside of your full-time job back in Oregon are making you a lot of money, and you know, you have multiple streams of revenue.
Yeah.
You think part of keeping that job is just so you can say to these people, fuck you. Like, I train, I hunt on my off days, on my PTO, if you will.
Yeah. That's not the reason why. It's pretty convenient to have the job to say that. To be honest, I have the job because when I got that job, I have a hard time forgetting how I felt when I got it. When I got it, I hadn't had anything really great going on. And I thought if I could get hired at the local water and power company, people always need water and power. It was just a good job. And it was like a job I could retire from. You know, I could work hard. I knew where I was going every day, and it was dependable, and my family relied on it. You know, I have people, you know, kids relying on me, a wife. And so I just remember how it felt. So right now, even with all the other successes, it's hard to forget that. I mean, I prayed to get that job. So leaving it, and now that was when I was just on the construction crew when I got that. Now I'm the superintendent. It's hard to, I don't know, it's hard to forget where I came from. And so I have a hard time. And plus I love the people. After 26 years, I know those people. They're, you know, I actually care and love them. It's just hard to quit, but also it's good for the must be nicers. I can say I still work too.
Yeah. Because I get those questions, or I get those responses. Like, it must be nice to be able to train all day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work here at BPN. I own BPN. I built BPN, and I'm training the same times you're training, 5 a.m. or 10 p.m.
Right.
You know, it's around work.
Yeah.
And it's like the iceberg analogy is people see the tip.
Yes.
They don't see what's underneath it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have a lot to hate. I mean, jacked, got a great life, got a awesome company. Everything's going good. You look good. You got a beautiful wife. It's like, it'd be easy to hate on that if you were that person. So that just comes with it. I mean, when you build something special, you put in the work, you know what it takes. Nobody else is going to get that. Some people will. Some people who have a good perspective, they'll be like, no, I want to emulate that guy. That guy's, you know, he's paving the way. And that's how I look at it too. It's like, let's pave the way. That was the whole point of the book, for people who maybe aren't as focused as they could be to achieve the most of their ability. let's show them, let's pave the way and say, you know what? I get it. I was there, but look what can happen with dedication and passion. And, you know, you're showing that every day. So it's just this, you know, life isn't as black and white as we think. Sometimes there's a lot of layers.
There's a lot of layers.
Yeah.
I, you know, speaking about working your full-time job and kind of would bring some passion behind it being dependable. You said, I interviewed a guy last week. His name was Ken Rideout. Mm. He said one of the main characteristics that he looks for in other people or he wants to build within himself is being dependable. Mm. And the older I get, the more dependable I want to be for other people, for my family, for, you know, I want to be able to depend on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of those things that a lot of people could focus more on is a lot of people are out there for themselves, right? When you're out there for yourself, you're going to get so far. You can only go so far by yourself. You can go a whole lot further together.
Yeah, it's true. That dependability piece, that kind of gets glossed over these days. But that's been a big part of my success. Just, what I would say is you're more talented than me. I will outwork you. That's all there's to it. Cause I don't out talent anybody. So even my regular job, I have never called in sick in 26 years. If I'm supposed to be there, I will be there. It doesn't matter. I will get there. You can count on me. I'll be dependable. And that leads to opportunities because when you're working for somebody, they want the guy they can count on, not the guy who kicks ass every once in a while, but then doesn't show up half the time. It's the guy that maybe he's not just the best of the best, but he's always here. He's always here. And I know I can count on him. That's me. So I never been blessed with being the best, the smartest, the richest, the whatever, but I'm there and you can count on me being here and I'm going to work hard for you. So that goes a long way. Just being dependable and showing up.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like I've learned a lot through the hiring process of building a team, building a culture. And sometimes the expert in a certain space or field isn't the best person for a team or for a job.
Right.
But you bring a bunch of people that you can depend on.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of what the military creates, right? Very dependable people.
Right.
You look to your left, your right, behind you, in front of you, and those people will fight with and for you.
Right.
And I'm sure you've kind of seen that on some big hunts with teams too.
Yeah. The best partner that I ever had was my buddy Roy, and I talk about him extensively in the book, Endure, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him because he got me started with bow hunting. But the thing that made him stand out is regardless of the hunt, regardless of how it was going or the challenge, he was always optimistic, always positive, is always going to work out. And that is really hard to find. Somebody who's, so we're talking about dependability, but then also they're an asset with attitude. Because attitude affects everything. How are you going into it? How are you looking at the challenge? Affects that decision, then many other decisions that lead up to it and away from it. So having somebody who I can count on, that was Roy, and who is always confident we were going to figure out a way to get it done, man, he was the best. He's the best. I'll never have a hunting partner as good as him. But yeah, it's the simple things in life. Show up, have a good attitude. You can have success.
Did you learn through Roy what true professional hunting looked like and felt like? Because you talk about in the book, there's this big difference between your recreational hunter and your professional hunter.
Right.
And when I think, I grew up in Pennsylvania and I think back to some of the kids I grew up around hunting.
Right.
It was kind of like you said, you grab a case of beer, you go onto camp. They get kind of shit-faced the night before, and then they're sitting in a blind during that day. And growing up, that was my interpretation of what hunting was.
Right.
But for you, I love this book by Seth Godin. It's called Purple Cow.
Okay.
And he talks about there's this word remarkable, and the word remarkable is so powerful, you can only use it for certain things. And it's so powerful and amazing that the opposite of great is remarkable.
Mm.
So it's saying like there's such this massive divide between things or people that are great and things or people that are remarkable.
Mm.
and to be like this remarkable hunter,
mm-hmm.
it's this utmost respect. It's this process.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you learn like this difference between the recreational hunter
yeah.
and this true remarkable professional?
Well, I kind of forced myself down that path because I started off like everybody else, but then I had success hunting and I wasn't really getting positive affirmation or feedback or anything from anybody for anything else in my life. And then I did with bow hunting. All of a sudden people started to pay attention and go, oh, good job, great job. And, you know, as a young man, we want that positive feedback from something. We want people to notice or pay attention. We're trying to fit in or these different things with, you know, going through life. But I realized, okay, so this felt good to be successful. I feel like I'm halfway decent at something finally. This is after high school and, you know, high school sports is over. So you need something. You're kind of directionless. So bow hunting gave me some positive affirmations. And I started to realize, man, I can be better at this, the better shape I'm in. The more serious I take it. If, of course, there's guys I grew up around who were like, as you described and as I described in the book, who were more like just getting away, getting a vacation, you know, a break from the everyday life. But I, on the other hand, was taking it so serious as like all I really cared about. I started training harder and harder and harder and being more disciplined. And then after people were paying attention, then I was writing articles. I was like, man, there's a responsibility with how I'm hunting and how I'm sharing this because not everybody hunts. So if I want people to understand how I perceive hunting and what it means to me, I got to do a better job explaining the story. And so it's been an evolution. Roy and I started, you said, did Roy expose the professional side of hunting to me? Not really, because we started at the same spot. We were both just kids in a small town. He did at the later stages of his life turn into a professional hunter because he was an outfitter and guide up in Alaska. And then that is professional hunting defined. You're helping people from like the lower 48 go up there and achieve a lifelong dream hunting in the mountains. And Roy had to be a pro. And then at that time, yeah, I still learned from him. We came up together. He had a specialty up there and I'd go up there and learn from him and watch him. And again, it was always just mostly how he took on challenge and the attitude associated. But yeah, it's a long grind, this journey. Everybody starts with like taking it as a recreation and then you turn it into it has to match your goals. And then it might be something completely different from where you started, but it defines you like bow hunting does me now.
When you started hunting, were you going out and just sitting in a blind waiting for someone to come across, or was it always this active?
Yeah.
Active hunt.
So Western hunting is different than back in PA where you are. There's so many hunters in PA. I think there's a million licensed hunters. It's one of the most populated hunting states. So people are very passionate about hunting, but the hunting is much different back there because so many people, there's not room to walk, you know, and your properties are smaller. Out West, there's so much public land and so many mountains and wilderness areas. It's always been an active pursuit. In the West, that's like a different style of hunting from, you know, Oregon to Wyoming to Colorado, all the Western states, Montana, compared to back East, it's like night and day different tactics. The hunt, you're still pursuing an animal, but different styles. So it's physical out West.
One of the things you said in the book, and we talked about this last night, you know, in regards to feedback, right? Like, while we were running last night, we kind of talked about this. And growing up, I didn't really understand the importance of feedback. And when you're younger, maybe like naive or more immature,
mm-hmm.
sometimes feedback is viewed as criticism.
Right.
And when you apply criticism to someone with some ego,
yes,
it's just like a disaster.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's never helps anyone.
Right.
But like feedback, when you can give feedback and you can receive feedback in an appropriate way,
mm-hmm.
and it develops you. I mean, it's powerful. And sometimes it comes from people
mm-hmm.
pulling you aside and giving you some feedback and taking feedback. When I was thinking about it more after our run last night, there's other things that provide feedback. And some of those things are like terrain. Like
yeah.
terrain will provide feedback for you. I'm not fit enough. or this animal provide feedback. Like, you are not strong enough. You cannot keep up with me.
Right.
And one of the things you say in the book is what you love about the backcountry is that it's an equalizer.
Yeah.
And I found that really powerful because as technology increases and develops, like we're minimizing and eliminating things that equalize us.
Right.
If you have more money, you can buy more things that advance you. Mm-hmm. You can wear different clothes. It makes you stand out.
Right.
But in the mountains, like you said, that equalizes man to your most raw form of, are you fit? Are you strong? Are you weak mentally, physically?
Right.
When did you identify what the backcountry could do to that kind of person?
I saw a lot of people who were better than me in all regards, like quit in the mountains. And I right away, I was like, wow, almost before the hunt started, just because the setting is so remote and so different from our normal life. So that expanse and the mountains and being on your own, it's a heavy weight to bear for some people because we're not used to it. And I saw people who were stronger, more successful, better athletes than me, throw in the towel very quickly. And I started to realize that, well, I don't want to throw in the towel and I still feel fine. And I have confidence back here. And it seemed like there was a gap. And I'm like, I'm on the right side of this gap. Can I make this gap bigger? Can I eliminate all the competition? And that's where I started the ultra marathons, because I figured it's, you know, the country doesn't change in size, but it does. And literally it won't change in size. Like the Eagle Cap Wilderness where I hunted was 30 miles wide by 60 miles long. So that's going to be the dimensions of it forever. But if I can run 100 miles in a day, like you do in an ultra marathon, that has essentially shrunk. Now I can get anywhere within that area within a day, within hours, and take full advantage of the country where the animals might be, and also create that gap between me and anybody else hunting back there. Because public lands, it's, you know, first man or all man, I guess only the strongest survive. And it's like whoever can maximize the opportunities, those are the guys who haul in elk meat home. And so I realized that, man, I don't have an advantage in everyday life, but I have an advantage up here if I play this right, up or in the mountains, back in the backcountry. And that was like the first time in my life where I thought, okay, now I call the shots. And that's a powerful feeling. And I've just been trying to ride that train ever since. And I'm better now and more, well, obviously you get tougher mentally the older you get. Young men, I don't think really have been through enough to be super mentally tough generally. But I'm better now physically and mentally than I was in my 20s. And so that's what the journey can do if living right, being dedicated towards something. You know, it used to be 54 was old. That was like an old man. Now, I mean, Joe and I are both 54 and we both feel great. So it's like, this journey is a long one. How are you going to experience it is the key.
You think that finding ways to suffer kind of builds this equalizer? Because, you know, if not everyone can go back in the backcountry and test themselves. And when I think back to ultras, like these ultra marathons, these big effort races, you know, you show up race day and everyone toes the line and you see all this different gear.
Mm-hmm.
You have the gearheads who show up like all specced out. They're probably wearing $5,000 worth of gear. And you see the other guy that shows up in an old pair of shoes and maybe an old Salomon pack.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you show up to that race and no one, like there's no really equal. Like your wealth, your money, or your status can get you to look a certain way when you show up. But when you're 80 miles into a 100-mile race, everyone looks like dog shit.
Yeah.
Right? And like your gear doesn't matter. You don't care what you're wearing anymore.
No.
It equalizes you. So I think of that in terms of suffering. It's sometimes looking for these moments of suffering or finding places to suffer.
Yeah.
Can equalize you and you break you down to your rawest form and foundation. And a lot of people never reach that because you can buy things that kind of pretty you up or paint this picture of what you yeah. want to be. You think that's part of chasing these ultras is, and I know a lot of it is to be the best hunter ever, to be a better yeah. hunter, but it's also a way to suffer.
It is. And I mean, Goggins has made it that quote famous is on the other side of suffering is greatness. But you mentioned society today. Today we're geared towards being comfortable. You're too hot, turn on the AC. You're too cold, turn on the heater. It's all this thing. It's you're never people, even people struggling are truly never suffering. Like in some countries in America, our suffering is different. So if you're never suffering, you're never, you know, challenging yourself, you're not going to taste that greatness. So yeah, I do think suffering is a key component to unlocking all the doors of your potential. And as you know, Courtney, you've had Courtney DeWalter on here, and she has a great, I don't know, saying too. So many is like, she wants to go into the pain cave, mm-hmm. right? And explore the pain cave. Most people knock on the door of the pain cave and like, okay, I'm not interested in anything in there. I want to leave. And then they do whatever they take to mitigate the pain. But when you accept the pain, and another quote I like is, you know, you make pain your friend and you're never alone. So when you accept the pain, it's like, this is part of this journey. And on the other side of this is going to be a reward. It's a different perspective. You know, life is perspective. It's how you're looking at these challenges. I did have one thought. You mentioned all the gearheads at the ultras and the guys who show up. The guys who make me nervous, my brother, he runs a lot of ultras too, but he'll show up with like a Western shirt with the sleeves cut off and a big beard and kind of beat up shoes because he's not buying shoes all the time. Those are the guys that make me nervous because when they can just show up to run 100 miles and they look like that, you know you're in for it.
I think my last race, I crossed a guy and we were 50 miles deep. He was wearing sandals. I was like, what the shit, man?
I know. Oh, there's so many tough people. But what we talked about this last night, I think they have an advantage over men. The women on these races at these ultra are so tough with endurance. They're just so good with pain. Doesn't seem fair. I think we need to somehow equalize. What are they doing now? Everybody. Oh yeah. I feel marginalized as a man.
We need to start having babies.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Cause then we'd be tougher. Yeah. I mean, it's got to help, but yeah, these women, it's like, oh, so tough. I'm so amazed by just how much they can push through in these races.
Well, it's interesting because everyone loves the concept of pain or suffering. Like one of the things that we say here at BPN is everyone loves the concept of growth and what growth sounds like and looks like.
Yeah.
But then when you finally get into the growing pains,
mm-hmm.
you dip your toe in it. People yeah. are like, I don't want a part of this.
Yeah.
3 months ago, you were talking about all you want to do is grow. And now here's yeah. the opportunity to grow. Yeah. And it's same thing like the pain cave or like these dark places yeah. that sometimes it gets romanticized
mm-hmm.
where people, they talk about the pain cave, but they've never yeah. been in it.
Right.
And they dip their toe.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, this ain't for me.
Right.
And it's like we talked about last night. Everyone likes the concept of a 100-mile race.
Yeah.
Until you get to mile 80.
Yeah.
And then yeah. no one wants in anymore.
No, no. And you know, I've learned a lot from Courtney in her journey too, because so she's best in the world, you know, the best woman ultra runner in the world. But her first 100-miler, she quit. I think I can't remember if she talked about that with you or not, but she was at mile 60. She didn't realize this pain thing was all part of the deal. She thought this pain was so bad she couldn't go any further. And you know, wasn't built for it. But once she realized, oh, this is what it's about. This is the whole thing. She's come back and I think that was at Rocky Raccoon maybe even when she threw in the towel, I think in 2012, if I remember right, but she's come back and won that race. But it was just that change in, she hasn't really changed as a person. She changed in how she perceived pain. And it's just like, when you look forward to it, as you say, it's hard. It's easy to say, really hard to embrace pain in the moment, but she's found a way to do it. So I try to learn from people like that.
You ever go out on some big hunts with people who don't have realistic expectations of what the backcountry will do to you and that hunt looks like?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, you mentioned it, things that sound good in concept. Well, we have photos in the backcountry, and the backcountry is so beautiful. It's like, a lot like Leadville when you ran there. I mean, you saw nothing more beautiful than the Colorado Mountains. So the hunt, that's the kind of images that are you capture on a hunt. Either if you're successful, you got your animal, you got camp, you're cooking backstraps if you kill a buck or a bull or something. You got the picturesque setting. You have all these things that look like so amazing. And people look at those pictures or the video and they say, I want to experience that. That's what I've always wanted to do. I've always dreamed of that. Fast forward to they're walking on the trail, the dust is coming up and their throat is dry and it feels, you know, like it's 100 degrees. It might be 100 degrees. And you haven't seen an animal in, you know, a week, and you're like, this is terrible. It's like, well, all those pictures are from this experience just like this, but they're a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. You still have to go through all the growing pains, as you say, but all the whole process of a hunt to get those snapshots, and people don't like that part. They just want the snapshot, the success.
They're wondering, why isn't the cool music playing in the background?
Yeah.
Where's the highlight
shot? They're real. They want to post a reel. And it's like, wait, where's my reel footage?
That might be like a new influencer trend where you get helicoptered into the backcountry, you get a few shots, a few photos, and then you're out.
Right. I know. Yeah. Influencers in the wild.
Yeah.
Isn't that a page?
Dude, you could make some money off that.
Yeah. Fly in a dead elk or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's but anything worthwhile. I mean, there's a reason why it's hard to obtain. You're going to have to not always suffer, but you're going to have to work your ass off. And that's just the way it goes.
One of the stats that really blew my mind in the book was the percentage of people who are successful in a hunt. Mm-hmm. Like 10% of the time you're successful in a hunt.
Yeah.
And I guess just put that into perspective. Like if you hunt once a year, you might be getting an elk one time every 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a shit performance. Like, yes,
I know. It's hard to build on that. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, people get pretty frustrated and throw in the towel. So a lot of bow hunters, because of that low success rate, they start bow hunting and then they like, okay, this is impossible. Then they go back to rifle hunting. So it's like bow hunting's always been that kind of high barrier of entry as far as if you're measuring success with dead animals.
Have you ever had any interest in rifle?
Yeah, I started rifle hunting. Yeah. So first 3 or 4 years, I was a rifle hunter. That's all I knew. I just deer hunted. It's all I could afford. And then my sons of both, they started rifle hunting too, because bow hunting is so hard. I wanted them to have some sort of success, something to build on, a positive experience. Bow hunting can be very frustrating. We talked about the low success rate. So they've both started with the rifle. So I've been around rifle hunting a lot. I just don't do it.
In terms of a hunt, because, you know, say someone's listening and their interpretation or understanding of a hunt is just like, we're just going out to kill an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to the whole recreational hunter versus professional hunter and having so much respect for the process and the animal. And you tell some stories in the book where you shot this elk in the backcountry and you missed the lung.
Mm-hmm.
And you wounded it,
mm-hmm.
and it ran off. And then the next morning you guys went back and found it and you ended up killing it. But mm-hmm. you laid in bed that night,
mm-hmm.
and you guys, you know, you all cried because
yeah,
you're worried about this animal not having this ethical kill.
Right.
I'd love to hear like what a perfect day, what a perfect hunt looks like, what it feels like, what it smells like
mm-hmm.
taking people through that experience, that emotional experience of why you keep doing it and what makes your sport different than the guy taking a six pack and going sitting in a blind.
Yeah. For me, the perfect day, I'll set the setting of this hunt, but I like wild country. I like big country. I like having this romanticized thought that there's nobody else been back here for years. Right. So where I got that in the lower 48, was in the thoroughfare of Wyoming, big mountain range. It's the largest roadless area in the lower 48. So I don't know. I can't remember how big it is, miles or acres, but it's very expansive. And back there, you're near Yellowstone Park, but of course that's protected, but it's the mountains that's in that same type of country. And because it's so wild, there's grizzlies, there's wolves, there's of course coyotes, there's mountain lions, and there's no, I mean, the traffic is, because to get where I was hunting, it was a 28-mile horseback ride. And then I was 10 miles from that to where I was doing this hunt I want to describe. That's so remote, you're just not going to see people. But my perfect hunt, it was back there. If I think about it right now, it's just like everything was perfect. So here's what I see. Getting up at camp, 4 a.m, getting some food. It's an outfitter camp, canvas tents. You can hear the horses in the dark rustling around. They need to eat too. Maybe just kind of gathering your gear together, because back there, anything can happen. Weather can move in. It's the high country. Because it's so remote, an injury can result in a life flight helicopter if there's one even available or can get back there. So you take all the gear you need to survive in case something happens. Your pack's all loaded up. Get over there, put in the panniers of the horse, take off before first light with the horse. And you get up to where you can hear some bugles, maybe get a good glassing point as the sun comes up. So the sun comes up, it's exposing this, the most picturesque setting you've ever seen, the most incredible mountains. It looks like, you know, God's paintbrush up there. It's just what you visualize when you think of wild and mountains. And as the sun comes up, of course, it's red, amber glow at first, and then color starts to come into the mountains, and then things start popping out. And then the colors are pretty vibrant in that perfect setting before the sun gets too high and too intense. But that's when you can glass the animals, because in that low, perfect light like that with the sun's still on the mountains, but the animals' hair glows. Deer are easier to see, even though they're dark gray by this time. Some might still have their summer coat, which is kind of reddish. Those will pop. The elk, which are creamy colored, those will really pop. And you can see elk from a great distance in that perfect light. So once the elk is spotted, you determine whether it's a big bull. The hunt I remember, it was in this remote basin. We went over, glassed down, and saw a black grizzly. It very dark. I mean, I thought it looked black, but it's definitely a grizzly bear, and it's going across the top of the basin. Below that was a herd of elk and a big bull. The wind is coming up because now the sun's up, so the thermals have warmed. So the wind is rising slowly as it comes. So I need to approach that bull from the top, right where that grizzly walked, is flipping rocks looking for food. I circle around him. He moves over towards the head of the basin. I go on his backside and drop down towards that bull. Had a guide with me. This is wilderness country, so in Wyoming, a guide is required. I like hunting on my own, but where it's required, it's required. But we move down towards that bull, and by now, it's pretty warm. The sun's been up. The dust is, you know, every step will be it'll stir the dust up. It'll come up with around your boot and settle back down. And I had the guide behind me doing a cow call. And a cow call is you're just mimicking a female elk. And it's just a ew, ew, like that. He's down. Wind's coming up. Good. So he's above me. So that bull is below me. I'm between the caller and the bull. The bull rips off a bugle. There's this thin row of trees, kind of stunted trees. Up in that high country, the growing season isn't very long because there's so much snow. So the growing season means that these trees grow pretty slow. So they stay small for a long time, years and years and years, and then they finally get bigger. Well, these trees are up about maybe 20 feet tall, probably pretty old trees because that growing season is so, this is 10,000 feet. So it's in snow a lot of the year until the spring and summer. But I see those trees and I use them as a screen. with this wind coming up, I can still see the wind every time, every once in a while. I have a wind checker, but I don't really need to because that dust around my boot is rising up the hill with the thermals. That bull actually comes from behind that strip of trees. By this time, I'm 50 yards away and he's walking and he can't see me. So that screen of trees is working perfect. And it's not clear enough where I can shoot. So I'm on my knees and I'm waiting for him. You still watch the wind the whole time because the wind switches for a second. And if you felt that wind on the back of your neck, it pushes your scent towards the bull. Bull's gone. That's how they survive, is their nose. Their defense system is nose, eyes, ears. So if they smell you, it's over. They can see you. And if you don't move for long enough, they'll stare, stare, stare. They're not sure what they saw. They thought they saw movement. Stare, stare, stare. You stay. You keep your head down. You don't want your eyes. A prey animal can feel the stare of a predator. So you keep your hat bill down over your eyes. You're looking kind of at the animal's feet. So I'm looking at his hooves. He's looking up towards me. And I see he starts to walk again. So I raise my bill back up and now I can just peek under my hat. But he's going further away. I try to hustle up because he's getting, every step he takes, he's getting further away. And their strides are long. So I'm trying to go slow. He's just a stride. He's an 800 pound animal that's, you know, 6 feet at the shoulders, head's going up higher. And his strides are long. I'm losing ground. So by the time I get up to where I get a clear shot, now he's out there at a pretty long bow range. He's out there over 80 yards. And the sun's right behind him. So he starts to make a dry wallow. He goes down with his antlers, and a dry wallow is there's no water. A lot of times these bulls want to get in a muddy wallow. They cool off. There's thoughts that mud sticking to their hide makes them look bigger. Animals can't communicate with voice, but they can with body language. So there's a thought that they feel like caking that mud on them by laying in a wet, muddy wallow makes them appear bigger. And they're so aggressive. So they got that testosterone raging through their body because this is a breeding season. This is when they breed the cows. Intense competition among bulls. Well, he starts making this dry wallow. There's no water, so there's no mud, but he gets this dust flying up and he's raking his antlers. Antlers are hitting dirt, scraping rocks. It's making it quite a racket just in the ground there, but this big dust flume is flying up. And I'm, you know, a long bow shot away, but I feel comfortable. I feel confident. This is, you know, 38 miles from the trailhead, as wild as you can get. Just saw a grizzly, heard wolves all night. This is the exact moment that I live for. As that dust settles and the bull stops, he's quartering away slightly. I range him with my range finder, tells me the yardage. I dial my sight. My sight is an adjustable sight, so I can dial it to the exact, has a pin, one pin. I can put it on the exact yardage that animal is that I range. So now it comes down to me making the shot and that animal cooperating and staying put. He's got cows, so he's never really staying put because he's worried about other bulls coming in. So he's keeping he's surveying the country below him where the cows are. He's watching for intruders. He's keeping an eye on predators because there's grizzlies and wolves around. And a lot of time these bulls in that country, they don't like to call as much because every time they call like a bugle, it'll bring predators because the predators know there's a herd there. They're not going to kill a big bull, but they're going to kill a calf or a cow. So the bulls know this. So he's not calling a ton because this country is so wild. He doesn't want those grizzlies in there, but he's calling enough just to keep the atmosphere there and to announce to other bulls that this is my herd, stay back. I come to full draw as he hesitates and he's looking down the hill. That dust is settling slowly. The sun is right behind him. So it's lit up. When I put my pin up to shoot, because I'm shooting into the sun, makes it very hard to see that pin. And it's so bright, but I'm looking at him and he's silhouetted in that dust and the sun there. And the pin comes down and it locks right on behind his shoulder where I want to shoot. I feel confident. I settle in. I level up my bow. There's a level on my bow sight. If you can't one way or the other, you can be off with your shot. You can't to the left. You might be off a foot to the left. Can't to the right, same way to the right. So I level up. I got my bubble on my sight right in the middle. I put my pin right behind his shoulder, a little back from the crease because her shoulder blade is pretty heavily boned. It'll stop an arrow if you hit that shoulder blade, or can stop an arrow. So I come back a few inches from the crease of his shoulder, settle in, level up, slowly feel that trigger I can feel with my index finger, trying to relax, deep breath, my heart feels calm, slowly applied pressure to that, to my release, and it releases and it lets that bowstring go. The bowstring pushes my arrow towards that bull. It's going about 290 feet a second by the time it leaves my bow. Bow releases, arrow's arcing towards that bull. He's still looking down the hill. I can watch that arrow track up into the sun, which is directly behind the bull, but that arrow goes up and I lose it in the sun. And then as the last moment, as it gets close to that bull, it drops down below his body line and strikes home perfectly behind his shoulder, about 8 inches up from the bottom of his body, exactly where you want the shot. The arrow cuts through both lungs, goes all the way through the bull, the 800 pound animal, and comes out on the other side. He runs 40 yards. He stopped. Dust is flying again. His blood pressure is dropping because an arrow kills by hemorrhage, not by shock. A bullet will kill by shock. It'll break bones and muscle and tear things. A loud noise that gets the animals wound up. With a bow shot perfect like that, he doesn't know what happened. They get jabbed all the time. They're very physical animals, giant animals. But that arrow goes through so fast, he doesn't know what happened. He ran 40 yards and all he knows is he's feeling lightheaded because his blood pressure dropped. His blood pressure, he keeps losing blood because that razor sharp broadhead has caused a big hemorrhage through his body cavity, through both lungs. And in seconds, he passes out and then dies from blood loss. This all happens. My shot was 80 yards. He ran 40 yards and piled up and he was dead in 10 seconds. I slowly make my way to the bull, kneel down, put my hand on him. I thank him for his sacrifice and I will honor his memory with his antlers will be under my wall. The meat will be in my freezer. I'm hauling a home on these first out of this wilderness on the horses, then get processed, then cut up, frozen, in my freezer to share with my friends and family. And that moment where I'm there with him, that is the vivid memory that I'll never forget. That whole experience I'll never forget, but that moment where the bull has fallen, he's fallen from my arrow, one arrow from my bow, a merciful death, a quick death, the best death a prey animal can ever have, because otherwise it's old age, starve, predators eat them as they die. They're not even dead yet. Predators will be eating them. Or another bull fighting will kill them. I found dead bulls out there from an antler wound in the neck. Or it's just plain starving because they can't move around enough to find food. A merciful death from a perfectly placed arrow is the best death they'll get. This is an old bull. He's lived his life 10 years back in the most wild country there is, in the lower 48, and he's done his job. The herd will survive. He's been a fixture in that country for many years, but there's young bulls to take his place, and to me, that's the perfect time.
And if someone isn't as professional a sense of training, of taking care of their fitness, of shooting 15,000 arrows a year, mm-hmm. and it's a non-ethical kill, mm-hmm. what does that look like? Like how is that death different?
So if you're to the right, you hit the shoulder blade. Like I said, this bull was facing to the right. And that'll be a wound that he probably won't die from. They're very tough animals. They're thick boned, like I said, heavily muscled. He'll have a sore shoulder. They're much tougher than we are. They live in the mountains 365 days a year. So we can't even stay out there one night without nearly dying from hypothermia. So they're built for that. So he could recover from a wound to the shoulder. If it hits to the left on the bull that was facing to the right, you're either going to hit the liver, which is behind the lungs, A liver will kill the bull. It'll take 8 hours. So it's going to be 8 hours of him bedded down. I don't know how they interpret pain. I know different than we do, but it's going to be uncomfortable. He's going to be uncomfortable and he's going to die because all your blood goes through your liver, but it's not going to be what I determine a merciful kill. It happens sometimes. No death. Anything that's alive clings to life. So I would expect nothing different. Nothing dies easy. Humans don't die easy. Animals don't die easy. That's just something that's living is going to cling to life. But he'll die. It'll take 8 hours. If you're further to the left and you hit guts, right through the stomach, you miss that liver, you're too far back, that death is going to be very elongated. That's going to be, it could be up to 24 hours and he's going to get very sick. And he will die eventually, but and they can cover a lot of distance before they get sick. That's a tough one to find the animal because with the archery shot, you find by following blood. So you go, you find your arrow if it came out, if it was a pass-through like that might, and I can look at that arrow and I can see what type of blood it is. And I can read where that animal hit if I'm unsure by what's on the arrow. A stomach shot, you're going to look and there'll be green, the grass, where it's digesting what it's been eating. It'll stink because there's in the stomach, it has to break that stuff down. So it's got an odor to it. And you know, there's going to be little blood because the stomach doesn't bleed like a muscle would bleed or like the lungs bleed or like, you know, a major artery bleeds. It doesn't bleed like that. So it's going to be very tough tracking. The animal can cover great distance and it is going to die. Yes. But finding it's going to be very hard. That's the worst case scenario. A gut shot animal is what every hunter tries to avoid because it's a longer death and it leaves very little blood to follow. So it's not easy to do. If you're not trained, you're not prepared for that, and you're not 100% confident that that arrow is going to go exactly where you want it to go, that animal's life and how it transitions to death, how it's going to die is in your hands. To me, there's nothing more serious than that. I can't take anything more serious than I'm trying to kill that animal and my behavior, my preparation, and the decisions I make is going to determine that animal's fate. I take that very seriously. If you're not 100% prepared, you shouldn't take a shot like I described at that distance, but you also should be disciplined in what you're capable of. I think people need to really think about when they let that arrow go, what that's going to mean to the animal. And that's what I try to think every day when I'm shooting, when I'm preparing, when I'm doing those 15,000 shots a year. It's not just because I like shooting a bow. It's because I feel a moral obligation to be the most merciful hunter I can be. And that's what I strive for in every hunt.
How much surface area coverage do you have to make that shot for the most ethical, fastest kill?
So if we're talking elk, lungs are, I mean, it's at least a 12-inch diameter area. Lungs are pretty big. I mean, there's a shoulder blade on one side. They kind of go, they start big towards behind the shoulder and then get smaller as they go towards the top, towards the back of the animal. And then the liver's kind of underneath where it gets smaller. But it's, if you, you know, it'd be a pretty good size area, like a smaller animal, like a deer, of course, would be smaller. A bear have, they're even a little bit smaller lungs, I think partly because they're hibernating for months out of the year. So their lungs aren't expanding. But an elk has a pretty generous size kill zone. So you should be able to make that shot if you put in the work.
So that's the thing with people ask me all the time, coming from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. you never got into hunting in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing back there that I was attracted to.
Yeah.
Like people around me growing up, they went out, they went to camp, they went and sat in a blind, like I said, and
mm-hmm.
they sat with a rifle. And that wasn't attractive to me.
Right.
But a hunt like that, mm-hmm. like, that's what I'd want to do. Like this is the process. You are trained. You are you're an expert. And even when you get out to the backcountry, you spot an elk and you get up on top of it within range, but you don't get a clear shot.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes just because you're within range doesn't mean you're getting a kill.
Right. Many times you don't. because so many variables have to come into play. And with archery, it's different than rifle. The angle of the animal that you're delivering that arrow into is everything. If it's quartering to you, so that means their head is closer and then the butt's further away at an angle. A rifle, you could shoot towards the front of the chest and go right through that near side shoulder and still get in his chest. An arrow won't do that. You shouldn't take a quartering to shot on a heavily boned animal like an elk, because they have all these, like their sternum, their ribs are really thick where they come off the sternum. Their shoulders are very heavily boned. Their shoulder blades are, you know, thick as this table seemingly. There's so much protection there from, because they're built for fighting and fighting another bull. So that front of their body is very protected. You want to come in on broadside, which means it perfectly sideways to you, or even quartering away, where you can come in from the back, like you go come in from the back behind the last rib and get up, and you try to go through that far side shoulder, last rib, far side shoulder, the arrow will go right through the lungs. That's a perfect shot, because you'll go through liver, lungs, you could even catch the heart. But you have to be very disciplined with the bow. You can get away with a lot more with the rifle on the angle, because it'll just blow right through it. It's just because you're in bow range doesn't mean you're going to get a shot. And then because you're so close, you can get picked up. The animal can see you, or the wind can switch. But they're so dialed in on catching movement because they've been hunted by, back there, grizzlies, wolves, and lions. They see anything move, and they look, and they're like, I saw something move. I don't smell anything, but something moved. And so you really have to be careful of your movement. So a lot of guys get into bow range, and as they're preparing to shoot, because they're right where they want to be, they've dreamt about this for months, they are too hasty in their action, and they get picked off in the animal spook.
So you're hunting out by yourself. You know, you're the predator in the sense of the hunt. But have you ever found yourself in a situation where you are the prey?
Yeah, those are the type of hunts that I love the most, I think. Because even when I grizzly hunt or brown bear hunt, or I've even been to Africa and hunted lion, I didn't kill one, but I've been in the wood in the back country of Africa with lions. But I don't take a sidearm myself. My attitude is, I'm trying to kill this animal with a bow. If something happens, tables turn, I get killed, that's just the way it goes. I understand how it works, and I'm willing to accept that risk. So the greatest hunts for me is when I have to be at my best, and that's the grizzly, brown bear, cave buffalo in Africa, lion in Africa. Those are the ones where you can't afford, you don't have the advantage, they have the advantage. You have a bow with an arrow. They have killer instinct, speed, power, perception and smell, sight, probably not as good, but pretty close, some of those animals. And they can hear much better. So they have all the advantages. And that's what I love. I love being in those intense situations. There's a hunt I did in Alaska where the brown bear gets up, he's 40 yards away and he's staring right at me. That moment, I have a bow, that moment is what I live for right there. And what's gonna happen? Don't know. I mean, is a bear gonna get up, see us, you know, they're all body language and size, and they can see somebody who weighs 170 pounds, it weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds more. Is he going to see like, oh, that's an inferior animal to me, I'm going to go kill it? Or am I going to make a good shot? Is it going to, after I shoot it, is it going to come to me, or is it going to run away? Those are the moments that I live for. And on that hunt, I came back 40 yards, made a perfect shot. The bear ran off and died in seconds. And that worked out. But it's like that, everything hanging in the balance, those are the moments that's what I think about every day. Those moments, that's living to me. That's the adventure I seek. And that's what drives me.
Do you ever carry a pistol?
No.
Never?
Mm-mm.
So it's just, it's all in.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah. It sounds weird. And I'm sure people won't get it, or they might think, they'll probably think I'm lying. People who don't know me, anybody who's hunted with me knows it's not what I do. I just don't take a gun. I don't like guns on my bow hunt. I'm not worried about being bailed out by a gun I kind of romanticize the experience, and this is just how it's supposed to be. I'm trying to kill them, and I'm at risk too. That's okay.
And this is your obsession.
Yes.
Pure obsession.
Yeah.
You ever feel bad for people who never find an obsession?
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, cause I was close to not finding it. You know, without bow hunting, you know, I was trying to get a job working in the woods as a, back there being a choker setter, you could make pretty good money just working on a logging crew and getting timber out. It's timber country back in Oregon. And I was, you know, they made $13 an hour to start. And that was what I do. I liked being in the woods. Seemed like a good way to make money. Loggers were tough. I'm like, that sounds cool, you know? So without bow hunting, who knows? So yeah, I feel terrible. I mean, if not for bow hunting, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I wouldn't be doing this tour, talking about this book and tour, which is, I hope, gives people like me who are right on the cusp of like, which direction is your life going? So people like me who can read this and say that, well, these tiny micro decisions lead this way, and who knows where that's ultimately going to go. But yeah, I mean, that's the biggest reason I wrote the book, is because going through life without finding your true purpose, I think, you know, as they say, a man's greatest regret is untapped potential. And I 100% agree. And I just think there's so many people out there who have amazing potential and an ability that if that was, you pulled back the curtains and you could see what your potential was and what you could do, could change, not the world, but change other people's lives and be a positive influence. And if you never find that, that'd be terrible. So I want people to find their true potential.
Well, a lot of people, I mean, it's sad, but a lot of people die without knowing their full potential or even a fraction of it.
Right? I know.
Like, you talk about like the what ifs a lot in the book.
Yeah.
And people live, you know, they're on their deathbed. What if I would have changed this? What could I have been?
Mm-hmm.
And Tucker Max, I read this quote by Tucker Max this one time, and he said his greatest fear in life is that when he dies and he goes to heaven, he meets the man that he could have been.
Right.
That's an eye-opener, because we have so much potential.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have so much, and it's really easy to say, must be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the beginning of looking at someone who is at a point in their life of, oh, must be nice to have that. Must be nice to have made the right decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that someone made the right decisions. You just made a decision. You just took a step.
Yeah.
It's just taking that first step and just,
right.
You know, it's the whole go one more or keep hammering mindset. Right.
Yeah.
It's sometimes you need that first win.
Yeah.
And that first win brings some confidence. And you realize, holy shit, like, where else can I take this?
Yeah.
What else is out there?
Yeah. It's just being in the game. It's just like, and Roy would say that too. When we were hunting, he'd say, I don't really know what to do, but let's get out there and see what happens. So you got to be out there. You know, I mean, just like in hunting, you're never going to kill anything from your couch wondering, you know, I wonder if it's hunting good. I wonder if the weather's good. I wonder what the animals are doing. Get out there and anything can happen, but you have to be out there, take that first step and just be in the woods. Or, and even with running, and I know you get this a lot too, but people don't know where to start. Start by getting out that freaking of that house, closing that door and just getting outside and just starting, just do something. And then you build on that. But it doesn't have to be anything crazy. It doesn't have to be, you know, a marathon, or it doesn't have to be an ultra marathon. It has to be walking around the block. That's where it starts. That's where everybody starts. You walk around the block, or maybe you run a mile, or maybe you walk a mile, and just that consistent effort will lead you to go one more, and then who knows where you end up.
Well, a lot of people look at you and I think they identify you as a runner.
Mm-hmm.
But am I correct in saying that you identify as a bow hunter? You run 100 mile, 200 plus mile races to be a better bow hunter.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not a runner. I mean, I've been around elite runners to know that, oh, that's an elite runner. I'm definitely not that, but everybody has goals and races and you want to get this time and you want to do that, but it's just like you, if you were focused on being the best runner you could be, you would get down to 165 pounds, right? But you're not trying to be the best runner. You're trying to be like a hybrid athlete, a balanced athlete, a strong man with great endurance. So there's going to be a middle ground there. For me, I'm trying to be the best bow hunter in the mountains I can be, and endurance and strength helps me. Endurance and strength aren't the goal. The goal is bow hunting. So they help me achieve my goal of being merciful and being the best I can be in the mountains. That's why I run.
And it's all out of respect for the animal.
Yeah. Yeah. And the experience. And just, I mean, we owe the land, the people who came before us, and the families that are back home supporting us and relying on the meat that I might bring home. We owe it to them to be our best. I mean, it's a responsibility. Being a hunter, there's some ethics involved. There's a personal accountability, but it's also you're representing this lifestyle. Being a hunter, where I came from, being a hunter was somebody who was revered and looked up to, like, oh, they always killed their buck that year. So that was somebody who people held up on a pedestal.
And then going into the book Endure, you know, you've been doing this for decades now,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, and it's really easy for people, like the iceberg analogy, someone mm-hmm. to look in at a glimpse of your life right now and say, yeah, this guy just, he had the skills. He had the talent right away. He went from 0 to 100 in 1 year, but you've been at this for a long time and just chipping away. You know, it's, I like to say that consistency compounds, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes you do something for 1, 3, 5, 10 years and you still haven't seen any results.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start picking up some momentum. Endure is the whole concept behind Endure. It's more than endurance races. It's more than going on these big hunts. It's life as a whole.
Yes.
It's all these things that have come together to influence the trajectory of your life.
Yeah. And that's what I said like earlier. I mean, you'll have more talent, but I'll outwork you. And that's the only reason anybody knows who I am is I've just been working for so long, could easily quit many times, wanted to quit, felt frustrated many times, felt like I wasn't getting opportunities, felt like I was powerless because I was relying on these magazines to give me an opportunity to write for them. There was no such thing as social media, so I didn't have that guaranteed outlet to share my experiences and paint that picture with words like I love to do. I didn't have it. I was relying on other people to give me that. And that was very frustrating because I thought I had the ability, but I just needed somebody to believe in me. And sometimes you're not going to have somebody to believe in you. You just got to keep at it. You keep at it and eventually they'll come around. And my whole thing, even with now people, I have partners who do believe in me, but I'm not happy there. I want to make our relationship a no-brainer for them to be like, yeah, we can't believe what Cam's doing or the people he's influencing or whatever. We thought we were happy here and you're doing more. So it's just like that never ending goal of first earning an opportunity, then making people believe in you, and then getting people as cheerleaders. And that can take, for me, 30 years. I mean, it was a grind. And how much time is 30 years or so many days where I'm like, I'm wasting my time or I'm, you know, spending too much money or too much time doing this. I'm away from my family. I'm not being a good dad or husband. I need to, you know, give up on this thing. But it's just like, it's just that something that is when you find your purpose, it's a long race. And eventually you keep at it long enough, you will outlast everybody else. And then you'll be the last one standing.
Yeah, it seems like it's a common question that people ask. A lot of people who have reached a level of success, no matter how you define that. And mm-hmm. it's like, what kept you going when you weren't seeing the results or why it wasn't paying off? I don't think there's typically an answer for it. I was either too dumb to stop
mm-hmm.
or something in your gut just felt right. Just say, keep going.
Yeah.
Just show up one more day. Just keep sticking it out. Because what you end up realizing is no one's ever going to care as much about your goals as you do.
Right.
And it's really hard to get people to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're going at it with hunting and training and ultras, and I'm sure people from the outside looking in were saying, the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Like why,
yeah.
Why are you doing all this stuff?
Yeah.
But something just feels right just to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, I got criticized a lot for how running marathons, people would mostly, that was within the industry. Because some hunters look at it like a way to get away, more of a recreation thing. They're not wanting to go run marathons to do this. So they, instead of saying, oh, you know, props, that's, man, he's working hard for that, they'd say, it's stupid. You don't need to do that. He was wasting his time. Cam thinks you need to run a marathon to kill an elk, which I've never said. I just do that. But people will try to shoot holes in that because it doesn't match what they want to do or their goals. So instead of, you know, realize or accepting that, oh, this guy's taking a different path, going to respect that, they'll just, you know, talk shit about it. But it can't be any different than your journey here. I mean, a supplement company, how unreal, you know, you're in the army. How unrealistic does it, I mean, it seems absurd to think that it would turn into what you have built here when you first started, right? I mean, so what kept you going?
It just felt right, right? Like I look back at when I first got started and you try to look back when you first got started and say, yeah, this is what I envisioned, but it never is.
No.
You know, what you envisioned it would look like is often a fraction of what it actually becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things you just keep showing up and doing a little bit more and a little bit more. And you get to a point where you realize, if this is something I actually want, there's nothing that's holding me back. The only thing that's holding me back is myself.
Right.
And it's really easy when you first get started and you look at people who are doing it or your heroes or these influential people, and you convince yourself that they have something that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
They have a skill. They have an experience. They have a gene that I don't have. And you finally realize there's nothing that really separates them other than they just kept sticking it out.
Yeah.
And just kept showing up day in and day out when they wanted to and when they didn't want to.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's a secret to it. And
that's it.
Most people end up quitting before they just scratch the surface.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's just time. It takes time. And I think it's like, it gives people who will stick with it even more power in this day and age, because they want that instant gratification. They want the instant results, because that's what social media kind of rewards. So it's probably going to make people that will stick to it and just put in time every day, day after day, work. It'll make those people even rise quicker, because society is going away from that hard work, grinded out mindset. But that's great for the people who will just keep hammering.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in it for the long haul, there's very few people who are patient enough to be it for the long haul. And you don't need instant gratification. And I'm assuming as we move forward in life, and this is why I'm nervous to have this daughter in the next 7 weeks, because I know in 15 years when, you know, she's older, I'm scared about how instant we want that gratification.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference. You can tell when someone's in it for the long haul and they're patient and they're willing to wait 10, 20, 30 years to see success. And then when someone wants it right now. And I think that's a gene. I think that's something that's embedded in you, and you can't really teach someone that.
Those are the people that I'm attracted to, the people who just work hard. The people who, for me, have the most impact on my life are the people who've just been grinding it out day after day after day. And I don't know if it's by accident or by design, but, you know, Rogan started, he started like anybody else over there in Northeastern, kind of by you, with no advantage. And look where he's at. A Courtney, you know, quitting her first 100. Emma, who I run with, been running since she was a little girl there in Crested Butte, Colorado, and now a three-time Olympian. And it's like those stories about these people just show up and everybody knows them now. Decades. This has been a decades-long journey. Yeah, you know about them now. And like Emma has 500,000 followers and it's amazing. Courtney, everybody loves Courtney. You know, Rogan, he's one of the most popular people in the world. But nobody knows. This has been, you know, for Rogan, he's 54. He's been working his ass off for 40 years, you know? And I don't know. Those are the type of people, you, your story. These are a type of people who I want to hang out with because I feel like these guys get it. They get what sacrifice is. They get that it's not going to happen overnight. But when it does happen, it's going to be incredible. And it can be incredible. It's up to you. But those are the type of people who are like, no, that's my, I don't know, that's who I want to learn from, grow from, and observe. And that's why it's been great to be here with you.
Well, that's some of the best years too, when you first get started, because when no one knows who you are, what you're doing, you can fail as many times as you want.
Yeah.
And no one cares.
Right.
Right. Like you said, nobody cares. Work harder.
Yeah.
And I mean, just applying it to hunting, for example, mm-hmm. when you first got started hunting and you went out on a hunt on your own, nobody cares if you made the kill or you didn't. And you just kept showing up to work harder and work harder because like you're not getting the kill in, you know, the 80s and 90s and then posting a photo on Instagram and getting mm-hmm. 3,000 comments and people saying good job. It's
right.
The win is carrying that elk back and putting mm-hmm. the meat in your freezer.
Yeah. And I even without that, even without nobody really caring, I cared so much about success. And it's like, you know, I wanted that more than anything. It's like I had my limits have changed, but I had no limits from what I knew. And now my limits are further down, further, and I accomplish more and do more things and have a different standard I set. But I still was pushing my limits at that time because I wanted that success more than anything. And it, if I didn't have it, it was devastating to me. 1 year in 1999, I was only successful on one hunt. I killed a bear in the Eagle Cap Wilderness. And that was the only successful hunt I had that whole year. And it almost, I mean, it was so hard to take because this is like, well, this is what I gear my life towards. I'm a bow hunter. I had this dream of killing a big bull elk. And I've failed all season. And that was the hardest lesson to learn. But it's like that failure is what's driven me to like, I can never be too prepared. It's never enough. And that's still been my attitude. So even without the pressure of having to perform for your followers or anything else, I've had that internal pressure that just wouldn't allow me to settle for anything less than my best.
I think that the obsession has to be internal.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not internal and if the obsession is for an external source or factor,
yeah,
there's no real passion behind it.
Yeah.
Like I have people that reach out to me and say, I want to start a business. What business should I start? What the fuck does it matter what I think?
I know.
How is that going to build any longevity into any of your plan?
No,
what are you obsessed with?
Right.
Because if you're not obsessed with it, when no one's watching, you're not going to care.
No. Yeah, I know. Nobody can tell you what you should. I mean, the obsession is, I don't know. I worry people can't find it or aren't exposed to enough things to find that thing that does it for them. And so all I know is I found bow hunting and then I found amazing people through bow hunting that have allowed me to just up my game. And it's like I say over and over, it's that perspective. So when you are around people who have that same winning mindset and are willing to just sacrifice, you can learn so much from those people. And it's like this journey as a human is so complicated, so up and down. And we're so, you know, emotional whims and different things affect us and different journeys or paths in our life. But man, being around like special people who inspire you, I don't know. That's been the greatest gift of my life is the people I've been able to meet.
And like you said last night when we finished the run, you talked about the power and seeing other people win too.
Mm-hmm.
It's really easy to think that, you know, in your life you have this bag and it has like these golden chips and mm-hmm. each one of those chips is a win. And if you give too many out to your friends or you praise too many other people around your circle with these golden chips, they're eventually going to run out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this endless bucket. Like, we want to see other people win. You want to see your friends win. You want to see your family win.
Mm-hmm.
You want to win yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And you want people to cheer you on as much as you're cheering them on.
Yeah. It's and I, you know, as a young man, I used to look at everybody's competition and think that if they're winning, that took from me, and it's not the case. And then it's like another shift I had. It's like, and people say this too, it's the more you give, the more you receive. I thought that was just talk. And then I've seen how generous Rogan is, for example, and he seems like life rewards him. So I tried to emulate that, and I've just been, I give as much as I can. I love giving. I mean, whether it's meat, money, whatever the case, but I've noticed that the more I've been not hoarding things for myself because I thought everybody's competition and the golden chips, as you mentioned, but I've been more giving and not really keep track of how much money I make, not really keep track of how much I have or anything really about a personal win, and been more generous with either words or whatever. I've received so much more. I've received so many more blessings because of that. I don't know if it's energy. I don't want to sound too like a hippie over here, but it's amazing. The more you give, it's definitely true, the more you receive.
You quoted in the book, Socrates, mm-hmm. he said, "It is a shame for a man to grow old without seeing the beauty and strength for which his body is capable." And I couldn't relate to that more. You know, I think of, I've been saying this to my wife, Steph, for the last couple of years. And I don't think she understands what I'm trying to say, but you said in the book too, where if you don't finish a day and you're not beat down and exhausted and there's a little bit of suffer and you just kind of, you put it all out there, you emptied your tank.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't finish days like that, you feel like you're cheating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're in this space where everyone wants to optimize everything and optimize the body and health. And I think we get away sometimes of just pushing the limits to find out what we are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't push, you don't sacrifice, you don't experience that suffering,
mm-hmm.
you leave potential on the table.
Right.
Has your mindset always been that way? Or did you have to learn that as you got older?
I learned that, and it's just, I just know how I feel. And it's like, I feel best when I'm exhausted for whatever reason, whether I want to give all I have, because I've always felt like naturally I don't have an advantage. I have to give more. That's been my whole thing. So the measurable is miles every day, because I can't go scout elk. I have to go to work, but I know I can sacrifice and get miles in every day. And sometimes I give up sleep to do that. And a lot of people, they get so protective over their sleep and their this or that and overtraining, they talk about all the time. I don't know. Personally, I don't know anybody who overtrains. I've never met somebody who's like truly overtrained. I'm sure there's professional athletes who have to be very intentional with their training. So I want to exclude them because they're the top, you know, 1% of 1%. But I see these people and they're worried about getting all their sleep while they're, you know, pushing 30, 40% of their potential. It's like, start giving 100%, then you can start worrying about rest. You know, don't worry about rest when you're barely doing anything. It's like your body's fine, trust me. So it's like you can't, I get the recovery and the sleep and how sacrifice works, but I think people get too wrapped up in all this optimization, you know, sleep, got to sleep at least 8 hours a day while they're not taking full advantage of their ability. If you start doing that, then yeah, let's talk about rest. But that's where I've been. I've never been where I feel like I'm not getting enough rest. It's more like I need to work more.
I think a lot of people want to estimate where their breaking point is without mm-hmm. actually trying to find right. their breaking point.
That's it.
I mean, I want to know where my breaking point's at.
Yeah.
It's really hard to find it.
It is. Yeah. I mean, that's what those long ultras can do that. And that's but still, even so, you just like life, you go through so many ups and down, ups and downs. I've been in ultras where it feels like I can't run another step. And then 5 hours later, I'm running free and strong. So when I finished Moab, 238.3 miles, I washed myself across the finish line. I knew how I felt back from the finish line. And it wasn't that great sometimes. Sometimes it was really good. Towards the end, it was really good. I come across that line and I'm like, I got more. That 238 miles isn't my breaking point. So what is it? Still looking. That's what's exciting.
Yeah, you kind of break down Courtney's run that she did. I think it was like 2 years ago is the 300 plus.
Yeah.
She was going for like 500 miles, I believe.
Yeah, the Colorado Trail.
She found her breaking point there. Mm-hmm. But sometimes your breaking point changes, right? Like there's factors that get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the power of these ultra races is there's these highs and lows.
Right.
Like huge highs and then huge lows. It's like running in general. If I'm going on a long run, I always know there's going to be a low.
Yeah.
But I always know that after that low, there's going to be a high.
Mm-hmm.
But I always know after that high, there's going to be another low.
Right.
And you're just... It's all mental, right? Like it's all mental. You're just in and out the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's just fighting back against that.
Yeah. And that what's amazing in that run where she ran 309 miles, then she ended up in ER, but it wasn't running wise. We were going up this one, I mean, pretty close to that 309 mile mark. I think maybe it was like 260, but a big steep climb. I mean, it was hard. And so I was going pretty good. I was with her and her husband, Kevin, was there too. And I thought we were pushing and like we're going to get a little gap on her and then wait for her to come up because probably I needed a little break. But I was pushing pretty hard and I look and she is right behind me. It's like, what? She'd been running for 4 days. And I felt like I was pushing. She's having, you know, she had bronchitis, which had kind of, I don't know if she's sick to start off, but the dust and the heat and everything got in her lungs. Got probably dehydrated from the inside out. And then also it was very warm. So she had a lot to overcome that she wasn't really at her best right there. And still, I mean, still crushing it. It's like, but like I say, she's showed me so much about, and her attitude that whole time, bloody nose.
Probably smiling.
Not smiling, but a pretty good attitude.
Yeah.
I mean, she was pretty fatigued, but it's 4 days though, dude. And we sat down to take a picture one time. She fell asleep. It was like in the I think might've been the last morning. I can't remember, but, so tired and would sleep on the trail for a few minutes every once in a while and still get up and just, I don't know. It's so amazing. So her limit that day or those days was 309, but I know she can do that. Colorado Trail. I know she can break the record. Record is, it was 8 days. She's trying to do it in 7 days. And, I know she'll, you know, if the time allows, I was like a COVID time. So the races were canceled. So it was a perfect opportunity to take on a challenge like that. But yeah, I mean, I love seeing people lay it all out on the line. Sometimes you win, sometimes you don't, but you always, you know, as they say, you always learn.
It's awesome to see people win and fail in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one, when you see someone fail, you know that they pushed it that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when someone who is a high achiever that fails is going to come back at it even harder.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, she bounced back from that. She's won a lot of races since then.
Yeah.
You know, just coming across that big smile she's famous for and just being a beast.
I love the whole keep hammering mindset. You know, it's very similar to go on more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way I live my life. And I'm sure it's the way you live your life. It's every day. How can I keep pushing just a little bit more? I always can go a little bit further, a little bit harder. I don't want to finish this life with the what ifs.
Right.
I want to know that I did everything I could. And I don't know if you're the same way, but I'm hard as shit on myself. I'll lay in bed at night and I'll tell myself, you're a fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
Like you are so much better than this. Like you can work so much harder. You can do so much mm-hmm. more. I'm never my own hype man. I'm always the guy that's talking shit to myself because you know what you're capable of,
mm-hmm.
truly capable of. And putting it all out there every single day is tough, but it's the only way you find it.
Sometimes I don't know what I'm capable of. Sometimes I do. I go through ups and downs where I was like, sometimes I'm like, well, I can do more. Maybe I can do more. And then there's some days where I'm like, I've been lucky. I've thought to myself, even on hunts, they're so hard. I've done it for 34 years now. Like, I thought to myself, have I got lucky for 34? I mean, it feels like I'm not very good at this sometimes. One person who's always there in my corner, who I gave him a book and I wrote in it, as Joe, he wrote the foreword. And I said, I wish I believed in myself as much as you believe in me, because he believes in me. I don't believe in me. So I'm like, just like you, and like so hard on myself. And it's like, I don't know if maybe that's a good thing too. I don't know. Cause I don't want to be the guy who thinks I'm better than I am, you know? Mm-hmm. So is this the opposite of that? So is that what we want? But I know sometimes I feel like I'm a fraud. I've got lucky. This is fake. Somebody's going to figure out that I'm really not that good. That's how I feel most of the time. So.
Well, when you put that much work into something, you know, you spend the time running, you train, you obsess on something. I think just when you keep doing that for a period of time, a long period of time, it builds this confidence, but also a level of doubt of where else can I take this?
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe, like I love saying that, I think doubt is only dangerous when you start doubting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure like when I got started doing all of this stuff, everyone doubted me.
Mm-hmm.
I doubted myself, right? Yeah. Everyone's telling you can't do this. My dad told me, you can't do this. You're not going to do this. Doubt is only dangerous when you start doubting yourself and you start believing these people.
Yeah.
But when you believe I can do whatever I want to do,
mm-hmm.
you have the confidence to actually put yourself out there and fail.
Yeah. Now take a risk.
Yeah. You need them.
Yeah. You got to take a risk. And that's what you've done here. And it's like, it's paying off big time. I'm so impressed.
I appreciate it.
And this is just like the studio, but I mean, when I walked through your whole office and saw all the I don't know. I can't tell you how, God, it feels good for me to see. I mean, you're a little bit older than my sons, I think. How old are you?
31.
Yeah. So just like when they're succeeding, I mean, I don't look as you like a son, but like a young man, it's like this success that you've had at 31, it's incredible. So I love seeing a generation younger than me essentially doing great things. Just like I'm proud of like Tanner Truitt and seeing what you're doing here. It's like you can be an inspiration probably to them to make a mark because you're doing it.
I appreciate that.
And I'm going to use you as an example.
That means a lot, Cam. I respect what you're doing, everything you've done, the way you've built your brand, the people that follow you, the keep hammering mindset. And I thoroughly enjoyed the book. It was an excellent book.
Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate the time today, man. I know you're a busy guy.
Yeah.
And I want a big book tour. But for anyone listening, Endure by Cameron Haynes is definitely one to pick up.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Bear Performance Podcast. Please leave a rating and review on the platform you are listening to if you enjoyed it. It helps us to grow and reach more people with the intent of changing lives through the Go One More mindset. If you are ready to take your health and performance to the next level, head over to bpnsubs.com to take the first step.